jabuca. Às vezes parece até que a gente...
Well, that about finishes up another episode. Another episode? Is this an episode of Radio Free Chico? You want to stay tuned momentarily for Peace and Social Justice with Chris Nelson. I'll see you again next week. We're playing out with Lenin. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Tchau. Já deu minha hora e eu não posso ficar. Tchau. A lua me chama, eu tenho que ir pra rua. Tchau. A lua.
At 16, showing up for class, I was out there in the rain, learning how to kick some ass. I was done at 16, using my mama's key. It was all on me, it was all on me.
Okay, Play God with Annie DeFranco. This is Chris. The show is called Peace and Justice. And we're here every Friday with you from 11:30 to 1 with rotating hosts. I have on the line with me, I hope, Iraya Robles. She is an organizer with Women's March Chico, a growing reproductive justice coalition. Hi, Iraya. Are you there?
Hi, Chris. Hi. Yes, I am here.
Yay.
Thanks for having me.
Good start. So, Iraya, I would like to ask you about the term reproductive justice. We see it a lot, we hear it a lot, but I'm not sure we understand it in the same depth that you do. Can you tell us what reproductive justice means to you?
Yeah, well, sorry, another call's coming in. I had to skip it. So reproductive justice is actually not a new term. One of the things that we've been seeing is a growing awareness of intersectionality. The term coined by Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, a black feminist in the late 80s, who was a legal professor, and she named in a specific way with that term connections, intersections of oppression and intersections of experience of oppression, systemic and interpersonal oppression that creates a very specific experience for everyone. Black, indigenous, Asian, Latin, Middle Eastern, women of color, people of color. And also there's parallel work to that term. And one of those parallels, one of the things that connects it all in terms of abortion as essential health care and abortion access for all is reproductive justice. Reproductive justice comes out of racial justice and gender justice movements. It's a term that was developed almost 30 years ago. Loretta Ross, who is a co-founder of the organization Sister Song, which was a coalition of 15 black, indigenous, and women of color, came together to create a coalition to talk about. It's not just about the medical procedure and having access, but it's about bodily autonomy, the way to choose or to not choose to have children. If you have children, the way you will be able to parent the children in a safe and sustainable community. So it's not necessarily just not a synonym for just abortions for people of color. It doesn't just even mean organizations or nonprofits or, just grassroots organizing by people of color. When we use the term reproductive justice, it's from a social justice and an intersectional analysis that we apply. So that it just means we include about how race, class, gender, identity, immigration status, disability, location, you know, to where you live, where you come from, where you grew up, and maybe where you migrate, and other levels of experience, and oppression, just all come together.
Yeah, that's important. It is. And you made me think so much about some of the politics right now regarding immigration and how it's the population's going down, so they're trying to pass legislation that would give more money for people to get married and have children. They want it's a form of white supremacy because they're aiming it at a population that is not immigrants when there's so many immigrants that need homes and need places to be. And, you know, they have violence often caused by our own military presence in their own countries. Anyway, it is huge, and I really appreciate you saying all that. Can you tell us about what is going on here in Chico and around the country, if you wish, in terms of Rising for Reproductive Justice this Saturday?
Thank you. I'd love to. This Saturday, October 2nd, is a national call to action that Women's March, the national chapter in D.C., put the call out for. Gosh, it's been about a month or so. They put the call out for folks to rally for reproductive justice, to rally for abortion justice, which is specifically around abortion rights and a response to the bills like SB8 in Texas, but the copycat bills that are just trying to be pushed through, which, you know, are something that people are not going to stand for. So what's happening is this Saturday, the Women's March DC chapter is going to lead with demands. They're going to be in front of the Supreme Court, ahead of the Supreme Court reconvening this upcoming Monday. And they're going to be leading for demands that Congress needs to pass the Women's Health Protection Act and the H Act, and to make abortion care and access available and accessible to all, but especially, you know, women and people in need of abortion, communities of color, LGBTQ+ communities, poor and low-income communities, immigrant folks, young people, abuse survivors, because there's that whole forced birth piece, which is really heinous. I mean, it all is. And marginalized communities in general. You know, if someone is unhoused, you know, housing justice is connected to reproductive justice. If we're dealing with systemic white supremacy and racism, you know, racial justice is connected to reproductive justice, gender justice, and gender inclusivity around all of these connections. And disability justice, that's a big one. You know, that connects to economic justice. So it's all connected, so the demands are going to be out. So there are over 650 actions now at this time.
Good.
There could be more coming in solidarity. Some are marches. They're going to, you know, going with their own protocols around that. Some are just virtual rallies. Some are just more visibility actions. We decided to do a combination of visibility action and a caravan. Sacramento is doing that as well. They're having a virtual rally. But in Chico, we're going to be meeting at 11 a.m. We have a few ways people can participate. You want to give the rundown on that?
Yeah, we have 4 minutes.
Okay, great. So the action, again, is called Rising for Reproductive Justice, a caravan and signs in the downtown Chico area. You can go to womensmarch.com to get all the details. We will be meeting at 11 a.m. for a car and bike caravan. If folks would like to participate in that, go to the womensmarch.com or .org website, sorry about that, and you can click on a widget, which you can select for the Chico area or for the zip code where you live. It'll take you to our action, and you'll see all of the channels to sign up. You can also go, if you're on Facebook, to Women's March Chico, the official page, and you will see our email there, which is, you ready? It's Chico Women March. There's no S. Chico Women March at gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And if you email there, you can sign up for the caravan and get more information. You can also be welcome to join walkable sign actions. We're going to have folks out at the plaza, downtown, joining the Chico Peace Endeavor Vigil at 3rd and Main. Is that right? 3rd and Main?
Yeah.
And at farmers markets, and you can bring your signs, you know, bring your PPE and your masks, bring your sunscreen, bring your water, it's going to be hot, bring a snack, pop by the farmers market maybe. Some people bring the chairs and just be out. And we're going to be out with signs from 11 to 2. And the caravan is going to be taken off about 11. And you can cheer on the caravan as it passes you by. And this is also a collaboration between many folks who've been able to come together to make this happen through the centering. It isn't the Women's March that we've had for the last few years under the previous administration. This is a new time. It's a new era. Make demands and be very clear about, you know, what we want to uplift and support, and just, you know, we're just saying that we are rising and we're mobilizing to defend and uplift reproductive justice, abortion justice, reproductive freedoms, abortion as essential health care, repro health and wellness, because it's a health and wellness issue as well, and repro rights and access for all.
Yeah, and men are invited too. This is a family-friendly action, so kids are more than welcome. Dogs are welcome. Let's take over downtown.
Cat on a leash. Some of you have some cute cats out there. You do. There's also I was going to say too. It's wheelchair and assistive equipment accessible. Simply because it's, you know, it's out on the streets and in, you know, our public areas. But we aren't having any ASL at this time because it's kind of a self-directed march. But we completely would love it if folks who are ASL interpreters wanted to come out and do the walkable sign actions and chant in ASL.
Right.
That would be great.
Right, that would be great. And so people are fancying up their cars and their bikes. They're making their own signs. It's going to be it's going to be hugely focused on visibility, correct?
Yeah.
All right.
It is. It's visibility, again, not a march or a rally, but a rally in the sense we are coming together and we are rising up for reproductive justice for all.
So, Iraya Robles, I always appreciate your organizing ability, and I wanted to see if you wanted to give us any last word in the last minute we have about the national picture on this. What would you say is the most important messaging for the people in Congress and the people around the country?
Well, you know, locally, our Congress isn't really representative. We need to change. So, you know, just to kind of keep it focused on the long game and the bigger picture of this is about bodily autonomy. This is about the ability for, you know, anyone, including, you know, people who have abortions, which includes, you know, women. It also includes, you know, non-binary people and trans folks, trans men and trans folks who are, you know, gender fluid and different genders, who people can get pregnant.
Exactly.
Who need abortions and folks who, you know, need that access. We need to uplift and make sure that messaging is there.
Right.
No matter who's in office, because this is a human rights issue.
Right. So our congressional district needs to change to represent all those people you discussed.
Yeah, we need a lot of A lot of change. Nothing represented. Sorry.
I want to thank you so much for being on the Peace and Justice show today. I'm going to go next to a guest that you suggested, so I'm going to move it along here, but I'll see you tomorrow, and thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, too. I look forward to seeing you, Al, and the Word, Women on Reproductive Justice, for Bike Ride, Peace and Denver Vigil, and the Repro Justice Coalition that has been growing.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, so unfortunately, the way I always time these shows, they are just like boom, boom, boom. And here's a song. This is from Singing the News, Linda Allen. How about Choice?
Young girl in a parking lot, pushing through the screaming faces, staring after blue shoelaces. She's at the clinic door. Now they hear her roar. You don't get to choose. You who do not know my story, you don't get to choose. You will never own this body, what I hold and what I lose. I choose. Woman at the clinic door, get some information. They tried to keep her out, and now they hear her shout. You don't get to choose. You do not know my story. You don't get to choose. You will never own this body, what I hold, what I do. I choose.
A deep human right to be able to choose what happens to your body. So that, again, was Linda Allen. I have on the phone with me a colleague from where I work, and I'm really grateful that she has stepped up to talk to us today. Her name is Laura Morehouse. She spent her life moving back and forth between Butte County and San Francisco Peninsula before finally deciding to put down roots here in Chico in 2014. She's been working in healthcare for roughly 10 years, and the last three have been spent at Women's Health Specialists, initially as a phone counselor before recently becoming the director's assistant. She has a passion for promoting healthcare equity and reproductive autonomy. Welcome to Peace and Justice Show, Laura Morehouse.
Hi, thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I know, you mentioned that you spent a lot of time in phone counseling, and what phone counselors often do is discuss with people how to access care, and they review with them their insurance and some of the dilemmas about accessing reproductive health care. Can you talk about some of the difficulties that people face in terms of accessing care?
Well, in Northern California, essentially above Sacramento, between us and Planned Parenthood, there are only 5 clinics that offer abortion services. And that's actually not entirely uncommon, because right now in the United States, only 10% of counties in the United States have abortion services. And there are even 5 states that only have one clinic. But a lot of Northern California residents face a lot of barriers accessing abortion services and reproductive health services in general, such as transportation. It especially affects families and women who are low income, who are working class. It disproportionately affects women of color. And they are just really facing a lot of barriers when it comes to having to take time off work, having to pay for services. There are a lot of people who are still uninsured. And so being able to access these services, it's not as easy as you think it is, even living in a state where we have legal abortion.
Yeah, that's right. You made me think of two cases. One is mammography, that in the rural areas, it's really hard for women to get access to good mammography services for any kind of clinical evaluation of breast problems. And then the second one is tubal ligation. Access to care for women seeking to limit their family size, they just can't get it.
Absolutely. Especially when it comes to the Medi-Cal managed care programs.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, Medi-Cal covers these services, but finding providers in these communities that accept these specific managed care Medi-Cals is incredibly difficult. You can refer a woman to five different locations, and none of these locations will accept that specific plan.
Yeah. And even when women can access abortion care, whether it's through medical abortion or for a therapeutic abortion, there's the follow-up care. Oftentimes, if a woman has any kind of medical emergency, can't be provided by some of these local rural places. They just don't know anything about women's health care. They don't have any trained staff.
Well, and a lot of the rural hospitals are faith-based. And so these women and these people who have sought abortion care, they're, you know, 4 hours away from a clinic. So if they have any concerns and they don't have transportation, their local health care setting is faith-based, and they may face discrimination.
Right, and I know so often we've been involved with trying to help women get to clinics. I've seen that over the years many times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would you want people to do in terms of these barriers to healthcare? How would you like them to get involved?
Honestly, going to things like the Women's March tomorrow, raising your voices, supporting organizations like Women on Reproductive Defense, which is a local organization mm-hmm. here in Chico.
Yeah.
These are ways that we can really help. Just refusing to be silenced. We're not going to back down. We're not going to be silenced. We're going to be heard is helpful, because this can really, really influence local law. It can really influence legislation. It can really also get our voices heard in medical settings as well.
Yeah, it's so true. And I wanted to be able to also talk more about reproductive justice. If you had anything you wanted to say, our last guest, Ariah Robles, talked about the intersectionality, and I know that this is an area of deep concern to you too. Go ahead, Laura Morehouse.
Really, just these bans and these restrictions are further impacting communities that have already faced systemic oppression. This includes low income to working class folks, people of color. And, you know, we're talking about reproductive justice here, not just abortion, but how intersectionality really can play a role in access to what is essential health care.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just for our listeners, because I don't know, you know, if everybody is using clinic services, you know, low-income services, but a lot of times, like I'm thinking of a colleague who needs medical care and can't get it, you know, that it's not a seamless journey between seeing a doctor and being able to get to a surgeon. It's not, you know, for me, the healthcare system is broken. It's totally broken. Mm-hmm. So looking at things like Medicare for All, you know, the Butte County Healthcare Coalition that's working on that is so important, because we have to go right past Doug LaMalfa and all the other barriers to our rural folks here being able to get the care they need. Last words, though, Laura, go ahead.
I really just feel that if these issues are important to your listeners, that they should make sure that they get out there and they vote, that they vote in local elections. That mm-hmm. way we can make a local impact.
Yes.
And that they get involved in things like the Women's March. Come down to Chico tomorrow. Come down to downtown tomorrow. Bring your signs. Sign up for the caravan action. Just do something. Don't just sit idly by and allow our reproductive autonomy to be stripped from us. We have a right to what happens to our bodies. We have a say in this.
Right. And you also had mentioned earlier a WORD, Women on Reproductive Defense. They are doing clinic defense all this month. So that's another way people could get involved, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let you go, but I really appreciate you and all the work you're doing there at Women's Health Specialists. Thank you so much, Laura Morehouse.
Thank you, Chris. We appreciate you. Take care.
All right, bye. Okay, you're at the Peace and Justice Program, and next week I'm going to have another great show for you, and I'm just so honored. Again, I always say this, but it's just such an honor for me to be here, so thank you for all you KZFR supporters and for keeping KZFR strong, and I can't wait till we're through COVID and we can get some new programmers on here and, you know, and really open things up for new generations of programmers, because this news and information segments could be anything you all wanted. This is your radio station, so always remember that if you ever have had a hankering to be a volunteer DJ, you can do it. So, anyway, Peace and Social Justice is made possible by all of you generous contributors, but also Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And Chico Performances, presenting David Sedaris on Tuesday, November 2nd at Laxon Auditorium. David Sedaris is America's preeminent humor writer, beloved for his personal essays and short stories, and a master of satire. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. And let's see. We're still pretty early here. I'm going to go ahead and read the next set of underwriters. Thank you to the Paradise Community Guilds. Fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. And Chico Racquet Club, presenting the annual Raymond Ball Balbutin Fall Tennis Tournament on October 8th, 9th, and 10th at 1629 Manzanita Avenue in Chico. Deadline to enter is Friday, October 1st, today. Got to get that in there. To participate, visit ChicoRacquetClub.com. The details are available at local number 530-895-1881 or Kevin, CRC, at ATT.net. Chico Racquet Club. Okay, so we're still 2 minutes shy of the top of the hour, but I'm just going to say to you that this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Our next guest might be a little bit controversial, so I'm going to read the disclaimer statement. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And I also wanted to let you know a couple of things. Let's see. Of course, I don't have my all these pieces of paper. Oh, dear. October 6th, there's going to be a climate adaptation workshop, what we can learn from traditional ecological knowledge. And this program is being brought to you from the KZFR studios that are on occupied Machupta land, which is obvious, I hope, to most of you. And right now we're coming up on the top of the hour, so I'm going to go to a song by Emma's Revolution and get our next guest on the line. Hang on, please.
My sights are on my target, enemy on the ground. Sitting in my office, nobody is around. Matching my coordinates, focusing my gaze. My finger presses enter, the building is ablaze. Dead Mujahideen beside the dead insurgents among the broken glass. A tiny lifeless body mangled by the killing game. Get my next assignment off to Pakistan. Sitting in my office, joystick in my hand. Set the screen for combat out there on killing drone.
All right. That's a little bit about drone warfare and robotics and just kind of the where war is going in terms of the how easy it is to kill people. Just wanted to let you know that anti-drone activists have blockaded the entrance of Creech Air Force Base. 25 activists from 12 states around the country blocked the main entrance to Creech on Thursday morning. And it's a good thing that activists continue to stand up against this kind of insanity. After 20 years, we spent $21 trillion on militarization, surveillance, and repression in the name of security. So, anyway, I'm going to move on to our next guest who's waiting on the line. And he is somebody that I respect so much. Dave Waddell is a contributor to ChicoSoul.org, which is an online newspaper. He's practiced and or taught journalism for 45 years. Waddell spent nearly 20 years as a newspaper reporter and editor, mostly at the Reading Record Searchlight. In 1996, he joined the journalism faculty at CSU Chico, where he advised the Orion for 15 plus years and retired as professor Emeritus. Chico State honored Waddell twice with diversity awards for his efforts to recruit and support students of color from distant locales. Waddell has reported frequently in recent years about law enforcement matters, including officer-involved shootings in Butte County, about which he is writing a book. He describes himself as a strong supporter of the people's right to know about public matters, and I think that would be apt. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, you have been hard at work, and there have been three articles that they're not just articles, because you include footage with them so that we can see, you know, what you've learned. And I wanted to be able to just let people know that some new legislation has been passed before we start talking that would decertify police for wrongdoing, so they could no longer be police. That was SB2, which is passed and signed. And then also SB16 legislation will make it easier to access public records, which we're going to be talking about, and it'll also shorten the amount of time that I know you have had to wait years to get information, and even so it's still redacted, and so a lot of times it's incomplete. And so let's go ahead, and why don't you give us an overview, why don't you, about your work, Dave Waddell?
Okay. I've been looking at the officer-involved shootings in Butte County ever since the Desmond Phillips case. I've been following them very closely, and I've also gone back and researched all of the killings in Butte County since Mike Ramsey took office in 1987. There's been 37, and 35 of those were handled by his vaunted officer-involved shooting protocol team, which has never, in even one case, recommended any criminal charges against any officer. So I've come to conclude after looking at all this information that, you know, the fix is in on investigations. Maybe I was naive not knowing that before, but the fix is in, and it's just a matter of developing a narrative to sell to the public via Chico's pretty accommodating news media. And so I've been trying to get records, because knowledge is power, and law enforcement agencies know that. And I've been trying to get records seriously since last July. And then with Chico PD since November, I've been trying to get records. And I wasn't able to really get anything important until I hired an attorney. A law firm out of San Francisco, the attorneys are Carl Olson and Aaron Field. And once I hired them, then I started to get the information that is published in these three recent articles in Chico Soul, and it will be developed more in my book. But yeah, I'd like to talk about the Chico Soul articles if a good time. Maybe take one at a time if we have the time to do that.
Yeah, let's go ahead, please.
Okay, the first article was kind of looked at the decision making that went into the Tyler Rushing shooting, behind the scenes, because for the first time, Chico Police Department released officer interview videos. Okay, they had never released those before to the Rushing family, and the Rushing family is involved in litigation, so they withheld those videos, but they released them to me after I got an attorney, and those were very illuminating about what went on. And in any event, as it turned out, the person who drove the decision to break into that bathroom at the title company downtown where Tyler Rushing was holed up, the decision to do that was really made by a young deputy, with a canine deputy, when it came down to it. It wasn't made by the lieutenant who had been on the scene for 18 minutes, or the sergeant turned it over to the sheriff's deputy with the canine to decide how to break in there. So anyway, they ended up busting in four officers and a dog, and, you know, it went horribly wrong. And 46 seconds later, the sergeant shot Tyler Rushing to his death. But it was just kind of alarming. I thought that, you know, a deputy who wasn't even involved in the primary agency, he was there because he had a canine and one from Chico PD wasn't available. He drove the plan to break in like that.
I hope people
that's
excuse
me. That's where I looked at that particular
Dave. I would hope people will go to ChicoSoul.org and read that and then see the footage. It's so crazy to see that footage. It's so terrible about especially that canine, how it amped up all the pressure and the panic and the whatever that was, you know, that frenzy in
Absolutely.
That room. So
and if I could say something about the canine.
Go ahead.
You know, wasn't in Mike Ramsey's report. He left so much out of his report that contradicted the shooting officer's story. But that canine had never had a bite before. And these officers that have, you know, a live bite on somebody, that it wasn't, you know, field training. And so he'd had this dog for 11 months, I think. And these officers are very eager to have a dog bite someone, so because if they don't bite somebody, you know, their use as a canine officer is you know of limited value if they're not never biting anybody. So anyway, they're eager to have it bite somebody, and even though there was blood on the floor, water, and which you know dogs do not respond well to anyway. You know, they entered with this dog, and the dog did not bite and hold Tyler, and that led to the led to all the chaos. So, and that wasn't the first time where an inexperienced dog has screwed everything up. It happened with the sheriff's another sheriff's dog. But anyway, I don't want to get out in the weeds on this stuff, but there's just so many side stories that didn't even make it into my Chico Soul stories. And the second story, you know, the most damning thing was the sheriff's deputy, Ian Dickerson. He actually told the truth throughout his whole interview, seemed to me. But he told the investigators that he was holding Tyler with both his hands when the sergeant rushed forward to shoot Tyler. And he shot him twice, once in the back, once in the neck. And so that wasn't in Ramsey's report either, that this deputy was holding with both hands. He was getting ready to sweep him to the floor, he said. And then Scott Ruppel, the sergeant, rushes forward and shoots him. So that was, and so we were able to knowing that information, we were able to go back and look at the body-worn camera video, and with a software that slowed the video down to like 30 images a second, we were able to see Ian Dickerson with his light blue plastic surgical gloves holding Tyler as Rupa was shooting him, just as he described it. So that was pretty powerful information, pretty powerful image. And also in that particular story, I talked about how Ruppel, the sergeant, thought Tyler was laughing at him in a mocking way just before he shot him, after Tyler had struck him with a pen, allegedly struck him with a pen. I think he did. And then because he was being attacked by a dog and he was in this frenzy thing, and he grabbed a pen out of another officer's pocket and was swinging it. He hit Ruppel with that. Ruppel backed off and then stepped forward quickly and shot Tyler, and then 3 weeks later, the sergeant was choking a guy in the back of a police vehicle. So his state of mind is, you know, when he's saying Tyler was laughing at him, Tyler had bled out for 45 minutes. He was in intense pain, couldn't breathe without great pain, and being attacked by a dog. I don't think he was doing much laughing.
I don't think so either. You know, Dave Waddell, I just want to let people know that Tyler's dad is going to be having, he's going to be going to the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on Tuesday, October 5th, and it will be on YouTube at 9 a.m. Tyler Rushing versus AGPP, if you want to find it. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a big day for the Rushing family. And I hope they get their day in court, because all of the information I just described about the officer holding Tyler, they can't introduce at that hearing at this point, because that's not what the appeal is about. But, you know, the Rushing family still wants their day in court, and that's a big hearing for them. If they get their day in court, then they can introduce all this information that became known after I got these videos from Chico PD. Moving on to the third story, which it's just a demoralizing thing, I think. Yes. When you look at the killing of Desmond Phillips, it's just a horrible, horrible thing. The evidence indicates that, first of all, the stories of these officers who shot Desmond and tased Desmond were very conflicting. You know, they just didn't make sense together. And they told totally different things in the very few seconds that between the time he was tased and the time they shot him 16 times with their Glocks. And it appears that, you know, at most Desmond had a little 10-inch piece of wood shatter in his hand, which is not going to do much damage to a cop in body armor. And they shoot him. Alex Fleer shoots at Desmond 9 times. And Jeremy Ganabin shoots at him 7 times. And they were shooting at him. One shot was, a very downward angle that penetrated his heart and was, immediately killed him, I'm sure. And so he's got a little stick in his hand. But they told very different stories about what happened. But the most believable story was told by a Sergeant Todd Lefkowitz. And he said, he was standing outside the door. He had just arrived as they entered. These two officers entered, and he saw Desmond get up from the tasing and basically jog vigorously in place. He just he did it on camera, and we have it a link to it on Chico's whole story. And doing what a former attorney for Desmond's family called a wild chicken dance, and he was basically jogging in place, his head's down. Fingers were extended is the way he does that dance. And this officer Lefkowitz, who teaches tasers for Chico PD, said it appeared to him, or he, Desmond was acting like someone who was receiving partial jolts from the taser still. And the officer who tased him said he was continuing to pull the trigger and release the trigger on that once Desmond stood up. So to me, here we have a guy who's in acute psychosis. When they busted open the door, he just stared at him expressionless. He's in acute psychosis. They tased him. He's continuing to get the taser jolts as he stands up when it malfunctions in some way. And, these panicked officers interpret these movements as whatever and start firing. And that's what I believe happened.
Yeah, I wanted to break in and say that, again, you put up footage and you see that they are telling conflicting stories. Mm-hmm. There are 3 conflicting stories there, about what's in his hand and what his arms are doing and whether he's going forward or sideways. And so then D.A. Ramsey brings them all together to sort of get them all on the same page, which you say is completely against how a DA is supposed to behave. What is something this good faith contamination of evidence?
Well, yeah, that's great. I'm glad you brought that up. That's a very important point. And it's really not. Fortunately, I have an expert named Seth Stoughton, who's a nationally recognized expert on police practices and especially police uses of force. He teaches at the University of South Carolina, at a law school there, and he's a former police officer, Tallahassee, Florida, and a former investigator for the state of Florida. And, he's written a book called Evaluating Police Uses of Force. So, every time something comes up where I have big questions, I call, I email him. And every time he responds at great length. And so I was kind of blown away when I found this video of Ramsey in this room with the two shooters, taser guy, their attorney, and two of his investigators. They're all crammed in his room. And this is 3 weeks after Desmond's killing and about a week before Ramsey issued his report exonerating the officers. And he basically just says, you know, let's talk about this. You know, if something sparks your memory, and, you know, you think, oh, yeah, this happened this way. It's not the way I originally said it, but it happened this way. So it's just like something Seth Stoughton says that no competent investigator would ever do. You keep the, you know, you get the witnesses separated, you get their stories, and later on you don't mix them up in the same bag and try to come up with a coherent. In fact, he said the only reason you would do that was to come up with a consistent, coherent story for them to tell, but that's not what an investigation is supposed to do.
That's a cover-up. It's just
arrive at the truth of what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's like, you know, that's like, I mean, to me, that's one of the smoking guns in my theory that the fix is in on all these investigations. Of course, the biggest smoking guns I found, and this is I haven't written about this for Chico Soul, but this will be in the book. Having to do with the notorious Patrick Feaster case in, I think it was 2015. And that's a pretty amazing case because how hard the DA's office worked to not prosecute him for anything is there's an amazing oral interview, or it wasn't videotaped, it was just audio interview of the guy Patrick Feaster shot from his hospital room. They barged in there like 2 days later, right after he got off the ventilators full of drugs. They don't ask him one question about the shooting. All they want to do, in my view, is dig up some kind of dirt on Andrew Thomas, the guy who got shot, as much dirt as they can to make him look as bad as he possibly can look. So in contrast to the officer who they suggested in the beginning had an accidental shooting.
Oh, no. I saw that footage. He just pulled out his gun and shot him point blank. It was cold-blooded murder.
It was cold.
Yeah.
It was
very cold. Yeah. So in all of this, it seems like Mr. Ramsey, his only goal isn't justice or truth. It is to protect police officers and to thwart people like you or the family, like in both cases, David Phillips and the Rushing family, from getting information for them being able to get even civil penalties against these people. What are your thoughts about the PD's efforts to thwart people's right to know and failure to retain public records and to all these inaccurate reports that are so carefully prepared by Mike Ramsey?
Chico PD, you know, seems to have entered a new era under Matt Madden. I think not necessarily a better one in terms of these records. Now, I'm going to be careful about how I characterize this because my attorney characterizes it one way and I might characterize it another. I don't want to get off the same page with him necessarily, but they use these records, now Chico PD and all these killings, they use these records to prepare an internal affairs report, okay, and they cite these records. And then so when I come along and request those public records, I should get all the reports they use in preparing their internal investigation, you know, their internal affairs report. What Chico PD did was, in at least four killings, the four most recent ones, was they did not retain those records. Mm. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean they shredded them? Does it mean they threw them in a garbage can? Does it mean they deleted them online? Does it mean they walked them back to Ramsey's office? I don't know what it means. Exactly. I suspect that. I think I know what it means. But let's just say they didn't retain their records. That's pretty I don't know. That's pretty strange in this era where, you know, but in any event, what has happened, my attorney threatened, Ramsey still had the records, my attorney threatened to make Ramsey have to redact the records and give them to me. At that point, Ramsey, after some delay, sent all those records back over to Chico PD again. And now Chico PD, for the first time, is actually giving me a deadline on when they're going to produce some records in the Stephen Best killing, which they produce almost nothing on that. They're now telling me they're going to have, they're going to be giving me those records very, very soon. That's all because I have an attorney. They, and it wouldn't be happening otherwise. But so Chico PD did not retain those records. They've had the records back now, and they're supposedly going to be giving them to me in an expedited manner. My attorney's confident of that. So we'll see.
I like that word, expedited.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, really. So when can we expect your book out? This is going to be fascinating, especially if you also have material about the Stephen Vest killing, because that was another horrible, tragic, impossible situation where they didn't have to kill this young man.
Exactly. And that was a very bad killing. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, Chico PD's never is rarely held to account for these things.
Mm-mm.
You know, I don't know that Steve, I don't know if there's been any lawsuit filed in that case. You know, I'm not sure what he had in terms of relatives. But these people, sometimes these people who are mentally ill and, you know, kind of off on their own, you know, there's nobody to sue the city over their death. So, you know, there's no accountability because there's no criminal accountability. And there's no civil accountability.
Right.
You know, unfortunately, you know, there was no civil punishment in the Phillips case. There was a pretty light one in the Myra Mukilisio case, you know, just $250,000 for a horrible killing. And, you know, on the other hand, Scott Rushing has resources, and he's pushed this to the appellate court, and and we'll see if he gets his day in court or not. But you know, it's sad to me that, you know, the Desmond Phillips case has not gotten the, that was just wrong.
Right, it was. Yeah, if it seems like it's also an issue of poverty. I mean,
yeah.
Tyler Rushing's dad, you know, has access to resources,
right.
And Desmond's dad didn't. And I've just felt like if he had had a forensics investigator in his apartment after that killing, they could have just, you know, they could have just wiped the floor with the police department and the DA. They could have won.
Yeah. I think they had a good case. I think it's unfortunate it didn't. And get a trial, but
yeah. So where do we go from here? I mean, I'm going to let you go, but I know this isn't your job as a journalist to say what we should be doing. But you know, obviously, voting out Ramsey is one way to go. But what are your thoughts for the listeners? I mean, I'm just furious about all this. What should we be doing?
I think Chico PD needs to be reformed. It seems like, you know, we've gotten the next old boy in line each time they have an opening there.
Right.
There was an opportunity in 2015 when Mike O'Brien took over from Mike Dunbaugh. You know, some reforms had been set in place. Mike O'Brien could have continued those, you know, but he was slow to get the body cameras on people and didn't get them on them until Desmond got killed. And then after Desmond got killed, 2 weeks later, you know, all of a sudden they can get him on the guys. But you know, and then the city manager chooses O'Brien's deputy and he does a nationwide search, and we get the next old boy in line.
Right.
And so nothing really changes, I don't think. And now one thing O'Brien did do that I applaud him for is he brought in a number of female officers, and this was a department that was known as, you know, kind of a good old boy department with poor community relations. And unfortunately, I don't think any of them have been promoted to the level of sergeant yet.
Right.
And they don't have a, amazingly, they don't have a female. And I looked at their employee list, and these aren't all sworn officers, but, you know, they got a ton of people working over there. But there's no female above the rank of police officer or detective, I don't believe.
Right, and it's the culture, so, too. I mean, even if they're females, it just sometimes doesn't matter. I have to let you go, Dave Waddell, but I'm looking forward to the book, and please let us know so we can get you back on when the book comes out.
Will do. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much for all your hard work.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye. All right, the Peace and Justice Show is followed by Playing Dead. That will be on at 1 o'clock, and so stay tuned. Our next guest, I just want to let you know this before I get him on the line. He is an Afghan evacuee. We will not be able to discuss the war in Afghanistan. We're not going to be using the word terrorist or Taliban or U.S. military or anything like that. He's very concerned about safety and security for people who are still living in Afghanistan. So I respect that. This is a song of beautiful Afghan culture. It's a love song, but it's also about separation, which is what everybody's going through right now.
مرا خون جگر کرد خدا
All right, so this is Chris, and that, like I said, that was a beautiful Afghani love song about separation between these lovers, and a lot of people have been separated from everything they knew and held dear, and we are lucky to speak with one of those people who was this pain in his heart right now. I'm speaking with Hanif Hadi. He is... he is the managing director for HRDWO, Human Rights Development and Welfare Organization. Their mission and main focus areas were bringing peace to educate and bring awareness about human rights, educating people about their social rights, especially women. In addition, they were reporting human rights violations in war zones for war victims, but also for prisoners and people experiencing domestic violence. He is in the United States now with his family, his parents, and his brothers, so most of his family is here in the U.S. This NGO has been working since 2009 and is registered with the government of Afghanistan, or the former government of Afghanistan, and was partnered with USAID, the UN, and multiple international organizations. Let's see.
Hanif Hadi is working on humanitarian assistance. He wants to help and be the voice for Afghans who don't have any relatives and voice here. He's here to help those families who don't have any relatives here in the U.S., especially widows, orphans, disabled, and young boys and girls. He's trying to find some sponsors for those who don't have any relatives here in the U.S. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Program, Hanif Hadi. Welcome to the U.S.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Chris.
Yeah, and I'm grateful that you are with me today, and I honor the difficulties you've seen in your life and what you're trying to do for your people. And so thank you for that. Can you tell this listening audience about yourself, what your regular life was like in Afghanistan, your family and your community there, so just so we can get kind of grounded into the reality that you left behind?
Yes, Chris. So since I was working back in Afghanistan, and all of you know that Afghanistan is in a conflict for the last 43 years, but since 2001, the life of most of the Afghani people and the Afghani population over there has been changed after the U.S. Arrival over there.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was a lot of development work done in the last 20 years. I came to the United States in 2006, but then I was going through and forth. And we were working there were multiple organizations. We were mostly working and trying to help the people, educate the people about their rights. We were trying to give them to those especially who don't have any access to the education system or those who need some kind of education. Mostly the problem is that the population over there, it's a war zone country. So the people back there, their life standard is pretty low. They are not only facing the war problems, they are also facing the poverty over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it's a poor country, and I think that many Americans don't really realize about what life was like outside of Kabul and the major cities, about the level of poverty that people lived under. And so the people that you're helping now, though, are people who were involved somewhat, I guess you would say, in the U.S. sector, or people who had education or for some reason were able to make a life for themselves beyond subsistence farming. Is that correct?
Yes.
Pretty much. And tell us a little bit about the complications. I know that everything changed drastically a month or so ago. And so, you were going along helping people, and then this huge shift came. And what has it been like since then?
Yes, Chris. After this change, if we go to the past 20 years, so there were three or four kinds of people. So one were those people who were dependent on the government job.
Mm-hmm.
The other were dependent on the private sector. The third one were all dependent on all these foreigners, NGOs and foreigner organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So after the change, the problem is that 4.2 million people, they have lost their jobs.
Wow.
So the thing is that there in these 4.2 million people, there were the private sector was a big partner of these people who were providing them different projects, especially the food project, the small businesses project. These organizations were funding a lot of those local shelters, a lot of local vocational trainings, a lot of local small schools. So after this change, everything is all these things is fully vanished, mm-hmm. and all these things are stopped, like all these activities are stopped. So now, like, if you go to the job ratio and the working people who are working, it goes all the way to 10 million people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're making me very aware of the famine that's to come, of the complete despair that's to come, that is probably already happening there. So your role in this as a quote-unquote survivor, I know you must have some feelings of desperation too. How has it been in adjustment with you and your family? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Like, I was there, I was working there. So after this change, like, me and my family, my parents, they were there too. Like, they went there for the vacation. But, like, then because of the COVID, they were stuck there. And then I went there. I went there for a few projects. We were doing, like, a school project, and then I was there for the last 6 months. And then suddenly this change happened. So, we were in the evacuees, but it was very fearful for us. It was not safe for us, but thanks God we made it happen.
Right. So you had to get out through that Kabul airport craziness? Is that, did it happen?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now we have, you're in the Sacramento area, I take it, and you're helping families who are evacuees, and they are starting a new life here. Can you tell us about, first of all, what do they arrive to? Do they have housing? Do they have furnishings? Do they, what kind of case management are they getting?
These evacuees, they are deployed first from Kabul, those people who made it. So first they are deployed to the closest country, and after that they go to another country, any of the European country, and after that they come to the USA. So once these people come to the United States, they have to stay for 4 to 6 weeks or 4 to 8 weeks in certain military bases. In the military bases, they work there with them to provide their, to manage their cases, to do like a fingerprints and medical checkups, and then to do their work permit, which is one of the most important part of this evacuation, and like most important part for those who are going to be living here in the United States. So after this process is completed, so they are giving these evacuees two options, whether if you have any family member or any friend or anybody, do you want to go there and want to stay with them, or you want to, or they refer them to certain refugee resettlement organization who help them. The help is not like for long time. They just help them and with their rent, with their, like, it's not like a full help. They just look at their resources, how much they can help them for the resettlement, to provide them like the a place for living, and yes, they do help with them to like apply for the cash aid or for the food stamps, and also like they ask some other organization, the refugee resettlement organization, to provide them like the furnished rooms and all those things. But that's not enough, because like the organization, they don't help that much resources to resettle these refugees. So this is one part of our work.
Yeah.
Then another part I will tell you later.
Okay. So I just wanted to tell our listeners, you are listening to the Peace and Justice Show. My guest is Hanif Hadi. He is a volunteer with his own NGO, but also with NorCal Resist. And I wanted to say that the good news is that the Biden administration has just passed legislation that will increase refugee resettlement benefits for humanitarian parolees from Afghanistan and expedite their parolee applications and help them with driver's licenses. And so hopefully things will improve soon. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is people's state of mind. I know it must be a rare thing to have a counselor or professional emotional support for people who that is culturally and linguistically appropriate for people. How are people coping when they come to the U.S. and it's such a jarring experience, Hanif?
These people who are here, it's really tough for them, especially the first few months are really tough for them. But the good thing is that, as you said, like these resettlement organization, the volunteers here, they are helping them. But it's like it's not a very easy process for the resettlement for them here in the United States. Because, like, they have to do to, as you said, like, they have to get their social security, they have to get their driving license. The thing is that, like, one tough part is that those people who have relatives here and those people who speak English, they have, like, at least this advantage to go through this thing. But for those people who don't speak English or their English is weak or they cannot write, so it's really a tough part for them.
Right. So you work with people you mentioned in describing yourself that you're working with people who are alone, you know, like widows and orphans, and that must be even harder. Can you tell us about your own caseload or the people that you personally are working with?
Yes, Chris. So right now I am working with few families in Bay Area, and then there is a few families in Sacramento, and then there are few families who are out of state. Right now, so with these people, so I am just doing like a translator job for them. It's really hard for them. But the social services, they are helping them, but the help is not enough for them because, like, they don't have any access. They cannot drive to go to the social services office. They cannot drive, like, to go to for grocery shopping, all these things. So it's a little tough for them. But I'm sure, like, after a few months, they will be able to go through all these things, and hopefully I'm very happy that a lot of volunteers and organizations are helping them. The other part is, like, right now, which I am working, are those widows, orphans, are those high-risk people who are left behind and who are there. So right now I am just those people who are already here. They are going through all this process. But right now my main focus is on those people who are left behind. And those people, so I am just focusing on those people who don't have any relatives here in the United States. I am just focusing on those people.
Wow. That's so amazing what you're doing. I wanted to just tell people that Sacramento is home to the largest community of resettled Afghan immigrants in the U.S. The current upheaval in Afghanistan has left many local Afghan people scared for relatives they left behind. Many have been trying for months, even years, to help relatives leave Afghanistan, but the process is even more incredibly slow and difficult now that we don't have an embassy. So there's this thing called humanitarian parole, and it allows people to enter the U.S. with opportunity for them to apply to regularize their status through family adjustment, asylum, or other legal pathways. But it's very expensive. It costs $575 per person, per family, even infants. And so, Hanif Hadi, you are working with NorCal Resist in terms of raising these funds. Can you talk to us about sponsorship and how our listeners can help?
Yes, Chris. Thank you so much. So this, as you said, this humanitarian parole. So most of the people who are in the United States, about 90% people, they are able to help like their relatives. Since I am a little bit separate from them, and I am mainly focusing on those people who don't have, who don't have any relatives here. So I'm mainly focusing on those. So the thing is that, like, it's really hard for me to, like, collect funds and to talk to other organizations. This is, like, the tough part is, like, as you said, it's like the application fee for this humanitarian parole is $575, and it's per person. It's even as you said, if it's an infinite, so still you have to pay this $575. That's one hurdle we have. The other one is we need sponsors. The sponsor is like, it's kind of affidavit of support which the government want to see these documents that, hey, like, if someone is coming from there, at least, like, here they have someone who can help them.
Mm-hmm.
So that we are stuck in this thing, for which we do need, like, some sponsors to come forward, and, like, if they are able to help us in this $575 fee, and then, like, if they are willing to sponsor a family from there, like those families who are in high risk, and those families who don't have that any relative here, and then those families, like, who are, like, widow or disabled, or those are, like, young kids and young girls. So, yeah, that's one thing I am especially focusing, and we really need some help for that.
Right. This is really critical for saving lives of people, bringing people out of Afghanistan, and it is a little complex. NorCal Resist is very much involved. They do humanitarian parole visa clinics, and they are trying to help 30 families right now with their urgent visa applications. So you can sponsor somebody and be the person that steps up and does the paperwork, $575 per person per family, or you can give to the pooling the money, which is, you know, what somebody like me is going to be doing. And I'm going to put the links on the Peace and Justice Program page here at KZFR. You just go to Friday, scroll down, and find the Peace and Justice show, and the information for this show will be there with the archive, so that you will be able to find the fundraising link and the mailing address if you'd like to write a check, which will go to NorCal Resist. And also, there are, at NorCal Resist, you'll find a video so that you can learn how to fill out the forms. And there's a fact sheet, there's a sign up, and you can save a life, basically. Is that right? I mean, this is life-saving, right?
It is a life-saving, yes.
Mm.
It is a life-saving.
Right. So it is really too bad. And there's another thing I think that all of us should be involved in, and this is something we can all do and doesn't cost a dime, and that's to get hold of our representatives and say that we want you to waive the $575. So there's no reason why these allies of ours, people that helped all through this 20 years of insanity, you know, the people that are the good people, you know, that we, to not leave them in harm's way and to waive this this amount of money so that it, to expedite people being able to get out. Do you want to add anything? We have about 2 minutes left, Hanif, and I want you to be able to, you know, say what you believe is most important for listeners.
Yes, Chris, thank you. So I would definitely say, like, if any of our listeners or anybody have any question, they want more information, so they, I'll be more than happy to answer their questions and discuss, like, the situation back there. I'm just telling them, like, the situation, I'm pretty sure, like, everybody know about, like, it's almost 1.5 months. And the situation over there is pretty bad. I can tell you, like, it's we cannot take out all of those people from there. But what we can do, let's do that our part, and let's contribute, like, what we can help them to save a life, to save a family life, and to save, like, those kids' lives, those girls', those boys' lives. So, yeah, that's what I would definitely ask these listeners to come forward and help these families.
Well, I just, you know, it really is chilling to think about what has happened there and, you know, how ill-prepared everyone was for, you know, for what did happen. And I think that there are so many good people everywhere. It's so wonderful to see, you know, the people that are coming together to help. But it's, you know, it's too few, and it's almost too late. But it has to be done, and it's complex. And I hope that people will do their utmost in order to, you know, this is a form of reparations. It is due to these people that we try to do what we can at this late date. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much, Hanif Hadi. And do you want to give, like, a last word? We have a minute left.
I would thank you so much for having me here, and I really appreciate all the North California, especially the Sacramento area people. They are already doing a lot, and I would still request them to come and let's do something for the humanity. So that would be my last word to all our listeners.
Thank you so much for being my guest on the Peace and Justice Show today. How would I say goodbye and thank you in your language?
Thank you. Khuda hafiz.
Khuda hafiz. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so another edition of the Peace and Justice program. It's time for you to listen to Playing Dead and unwind a little bit from that intensity, as I will also. I'm going to go home and write a check. And next week, I'm going to continue that discussion somewhat with NorCal Resist. I'm going to have Autumn Gonzalez on the show so we can learn more about this program and the work that they're doing with refugees and immigrants and evacuees. So stay tuned. And I want to thank again all of you KZFR supporters. And at this time, I'd like to thank specifically Jim Truck, Chico's Mobile Gym Service. Jim Truck brings the equipment, knowledge, and fitness professionals right to your door. You provide a 5-foot by 5-foot space. Programs include one-on-one and group trainings, nutrition, and more. Details at Jim, that's G-Y-M, Truck, Chico.com, and 781-3961. Jim Truck, Chico's Mobile Gym Service. Also, Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920.
Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. And let's go ahead to the community calendar and then stay tuned for Playing Dead. And I wish you peace, all of you folks, you good people. Here we go. Bye.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Soul of California, an evening of live music, will be held on Saturday, September 25th from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. This event is being put on by Sunset River Resort, and all proceeds from the concert will go to support those displaced by the North Complex and Dixie wildfires. Taking place on the banks of the Feather, Soul of California is the first of a series of live music concerts and events. Tickets are $15 each. Children under 16 are free. Tickets can be found via Eventbrite. And for event and ticket information, you can call 530-521-2081. If you have an event you'd like on the community calendar, let me know by sending us an email at cc@kzfr.org. This is the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar.
Alrighty. Thank you, Chris, for another wonderful show. My name's Ray. I'll be your host today on Playing Dead. Music of the Grateful Dead every Friday afternoon. Hey, there they are now. All right, a little early. We're going to go back to Madison Square Garden. We did a garden show. I think it was an 81 garden show a couple of weeks ago. We're going to jump ahead to 1987 for a really fun show on September 16th. Maybe it's the 18th. Yeah, there it is. September 18th, 1987, MSG, Madison Square Garden. So let's thank our underwriters. We'll get right to it. Try to keep the mix fresh for you guys. And, I got a nice Candyman and a Walking Blues coming up in this set. And Shakedown second set opener. So should be a fun show today. Thanks for tuning in. If you go to Playing Dead on KZFR, you'll find today's set list and some photos from the show. Did a lot of nice posts this week on that as well. If you're into all the little Grateful Dead happenings around, trivia, birthdays, those kind of things, I know it. For me, I always get excited when I see new photos and stuff that I haven't seen before. So nice way to geek on in. All righty, we want to thank Jeep Print Shop, a small local Chico screen printer that loves great design, small businesses, musicians, educators, and creative customers. Jeep Trail Print Shop supplies uses water-based screen printing techniques and brings your vision to life for you. More information by calling 530-415-6244 or at jeeptrailprint.com. And we also want to thank Chico Performances, presenting from America's Got Talent, Tape Face. On Saturday, October 9th at Laxon Auditorium, Tape Face combines acting, comedy, mime, and creative genius to create